past, our public lands were the essential candy store of the oil and gas industry. Walk in and take whatever they wanted.
The Interior Department announces major changes to the onshore oil and gas leasing program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 6th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a subsistence case brings attention to a thorny issue.
We've got everything we wanted because people focused on our little case in Angoon and realized that subsistence was broken.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Obama administration announced today reforms to the nation's onshore oil and gas leasing program. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says it means closer scrutiny of lease sales, more public input, and stricter environmental reviews.
Today, we are announcing major reforms of the nation's onshore oil and gas leasing program that will result in better protection of America's great outdoors and public lands. It will result in more certainty for investors and the oil and gas industry. It will also result in better value and better leasing decisions on behalf of the American taxpayer.
Under Salazar's direction, the Bureau of Land Management is issuing a new draft leasing policy for agency review that will require better environmental documentation and more public participation. Salazar says that should curb protests and reduce the amount of money spent litigating controversial sales. The secretary says BLM will engage the public in master leasing and development plans before allowing leasing in areas where intense development could occur. In Alaska, the changes could affect lease sales in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, but the impact is expected to be greater in the lower 48 states, where leases are done more often on a quarterly basis. The BLM office in Alaska said today it would not comment since the changes are in draft form. Environmental groups like the Alaska Wilderness League welcomed the news. Jeremiah Millen is in its Anchorage office, says he hopes the changes steer BLM toward protecting public lands for future generations.
It's definitely a positive change in tone. I think we'll wait to see exactly what it means. However, any greater scrutiny over oil and gas leasing and efforts to include a better review of leasing before it takes place, I think is better, not only for the environment, but for all of those that depend on it.
Alaska senators warned the new procedures could delay oil and gas development. Oil and gas trade group, the American Petroleum Institute, called Salazar's comments double talk. Senior policy advisor Richard Ranger says it could make leasing on public lands more difficult.
We're disappointed in this direction that the secretary has taken. We think that the outcome of these measures will be to impose new delays, new hurdles, and new restrictions on the orderly exploration and development of energy resources in the American West.
Secretary Salazar bristled at the suggestion that he's trying to shut down development, but he said the public's interest is the top priority, not the oil and gas industries.
In the past, our public lands were the essential candy store of the oil and gas industry. Walk in and take whatever they wanted. And that's not the way it ought to be done.
Officials said BLM will continue to accept industry suggestions of where to hold lease sales, but it will focus on areas already open to development and examine new areas carefully. Today, Anchorage's Energy Task Force heard a preliminary report from the state saying that the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Reserve will be able to satisfy local demands into the next decade. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Judy Brady chairs Anchorage's Energy Task Force. Although reserving some judgment on the supply prediction, Brady sees this latest report as providing a much-needed baseline for her group and the involved utilities.
It was very helpful. Department of Natural Resources has been doing gas studies for years. But this one has been done a little bit differently, and so it's going to give some good talking points, some good places to start discussion.
Brady is referring to the summary report presented to the task force by Kevin Banks. Banks heads the Division of Oil and Gas within the state's Department of Natural Resources. Banks says the study, Preliminary Engineering and Geological Evaluation of Remaining Cook Inlet Gas Reserves, should allay the public's worst fears of running out of natural gas, at least in the immediate future.
I would say the popular conception has been that there's something of an emergency surrounding the supply of gas. Our study shows that at least on an annual average basis, that we have enough gas in the Cook Inlet to supply local uses for the next decade and perhaps longer.
That means, Banks said during his report, as we seek solutions, we can't dither, but we can be thoughtful. The oil and gas director said the study used both engineering and geological evaluations. The engineering approach looked at existing production in Cook Inlet's 28 fields. The geologic volume estimates focused on four major fields: North Cook Inlet, Beluga River, MacArthur River, and Danilchik. Some producers said earlier state estimates on natural gas reserves and resources in Cook Inlet were too optimistic. Banks doesn't feel that's the case with this study. He says the department sometimes possesses more overall information than individual well producers do.
I think we're being fairly realistic in our estimate. I know our geologists, when given a choice of making an assumption that will lean towards more gas or less gas, they frequently said, well, let's be conservative in this assumption.
Banks says the new study showed him that there's probably more gas than previously thought. However, his summary also included data that indicated some possible gas sources most likely involved increased costs and risks to the producer. Cost estimates for the producers and ultimately the consumers were not part of the report. Nor, says Banks, was the key factor of deliverability.
Cold spells can be our undoing. There are conditions in the Cook Inlet where during very cold days, the demand for gas could approach the limit of the system to supply gas.
It was the vulnerability of the gas delivery system during cold spells that prompted Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan to form the Energy Task Force. And solving that problem, says Chairwoman Brady, remains one of its key goals. In his report on Cook Inlet gas supplies, Banks also noted how the state could assist the producers.
The market is occupied by just a very few sellers and very few buyers, so there's a role for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to play in terms of monitoring and dealing with the kinds of gas supply contracts that come to them for their approval.
Banks says state incentives might support future drilling or expanding storage capacity, the latter helping in times of extended cold and strained supplies. But he also told the group the public should be aware that state incentives would focus on increasing the supply of natural gas, not lowering the cost of customers' heating and electrical bills. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The legislature is also looking at ways to improve the energy stability of South Central Alaska. House Speaker Mike Chenault and Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker have prepared what they call the Cook Inlet Recovery Act for introduction in the session that begins later this month. The bill provides tax incentives for gas exploration in Cook Inlet and for gas storage facilities to make use of year-round production. Speaker Chenault from Kenai says the bill recognizes the high cost of drilling in the area, despite state estimates of a high volume of gas to be discovered.
We're looking at ways to incentivize producers to come into the Cook Inlet and explore for gas. So, we don't have all the parts and pieces, how much, what's it going to take. That'll be done through negotiations, but certainly we think we've got to be in the forefront and work toward ensuring that South Central doesn't run out of natural gas on that coldest day in January or February when it's 40 below.
The bill also addresses what many see as a state roadblock to future exploration, recent rulings by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Chenault says the RCA has rejected several negotiated supply contracts between producers and local utilities. The bill directs the commission to consider the public benefit of having gas available rather than insisting on a specific pricing method. He says he recognizes that price increases might be necessary to cover the costs of exploration and production.
The RCA shouldn't stand in the way of contracts. Certainly we want they are there for one reason, and that is to make sure that consumers are protected. But you can be so zealous in one direction that your protection of the consumers ends up turning the heat off to a consumer's home in the middle of the winter.
Chenault says the goal of the legislation he's offering is to make certain that South Central doesn't go cold in the middle of the winter. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hunters in Western Alaska are ready to fill their freezers.
There's wolves coming through town, and that wasn't the case 20 years ago, and I could only suspect that's because they are following the moose.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
Trustees for Alaska filed a lawsuit in federal court today alleging the Alaska Railroad and Aurora Energy are violating the Clean Water Act every time coal is loaded onto barges at Seward. The suit comes after residents of Seward have complained for years that fugitive dust from coal piles and coal falling off conveyors is polluting Resurrection Bay and the lungs of Seward residents. Attorney Austin Williams says trustees gets complaints from residents when windy conditions blow coal dust around the community or loading of coal for shipment is taking place.
Any time that the conveyor is operated, loading coal onto transport ships, we get reports of, you know, significant volumes of coal falling into the bay from the conveyor structure.
Williams says it's not known how much coal makes its way into Resurrection Bay, but he says photographic documentation shows coal dust and coal falling from the conveyor, as well as coal being pushed into the bay during snow removal. He says trustees filed a 60-day letter of intent to sue more than 60 days ago and had no response from either the Alaska Railroad or Aurora Energy, a Usabelli Coal Company division.
You know, it really is unfortunate that this issue has escalated as it has, but short of filing the lawsuit, there really aren't any other ways for us to get real action from the railroad or Aurora Energy towards resolving this issue.
Williams says residents of Seward have complained to the State Department of Environmental Conservation and the EPA, but have not had their complaints addressed. He says trustees would like the Alaska Railroad and Aurora Energy to acknowledge there have been ongoing violations of the Clean Water Act and to resolve it.
Really, this can be solved by taking, you know, the appropriate measures to prevent continued discharge of coal dust into the bay and obtaining a Clean Water Act permit.
Calls for comment to the Alaska Railroad, Aurora Energy, Usabelli Coal, and DEC were not returned. A group of Southeast Native organizations has created a legal defense fund to protect subsistence rights. One of the first cases for the Alaska Subsistence Defense Fund will be the trial of State Senator Albert Kukesh and three other men charged with overfishing their subsistence sockeye permits near Angoon this summer. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Senator Kukesh and three other men, Rocky Estrada, Scott Hunter, and Stanley Johnson, were cited by state troopers on July 12th for possessing a total of 148 sockeye in Kanalshku Bay on Admiralty Island. The 73 fish over the limit were seized by troopers and distributed at the Angoon Senior Center. Kukesh and the others were each fined $500. They pleaded not guilty this past August in an Angoon district court normally presided over by Kukesh's daughter, Magistrate Elaine Kukesh. Superior Court Judge David George has been assigned the case in her stead. Bob Losher is the subsistence chairman of the Alaska Native Brotherhood's Grand Camp Committee, which is spearheading the legal defense fund. Losher says the defendants have decided to challenge the state's authority to enforce subsistence regulations on federal lands.
We believe in defendants that believe that the state of Alaska does not have jurisdiction to undertake the management or enforcement of subsistence on Admiralty Island. And so the motions have been filed to dismiss and also to enjoin the state of Alaska from implementing Title 8 of ANILCA on Admiralty Island. Also, we've asked the attorneys to make motions to transfer the case to the federal court.
The organizers of the Legal Defense Fund consulted with many of the relatively small pool of experts in Indian law in the state. No one contacted for this story was available to go on record and speak to the merits of the argument regarding the state's jurisdiction. One expert not involved in the case suggested that the removal to a federal court requested by the defendants was rare. Usually, there has to be a conflict of state and federal law, a difference in the amount of fish allowed, for instance, or a conflict in boundaries. Since no such conflict exists, this may be just a test of the legitimacy of dual management, the state's enforcement of federal subsistence rules. That's the way Senator Gukesh sees it.
I'm in a state court with a state citation and a state judge, and they interpret state law. I really think that there's going to be a time I'm going to have to pay the $500 fine, but as far as I'm concerned, we got the feds to look at it, we got the feds to do the review, we have agreed that subsistence is broken in Alaska. They agreed that we look at the Federal Subsistence Board and try to revamp that. We've got everything we wanted because people focused on our little case in Angoon and realized that subsistence was broken.
Gukesh says he has no plans to introduce any legislation this coming session to address the conflict in subsistence management in the state. He agrees with Bob Loescher that now is the time for subsistence users to put their energy into the recently reinvigorated Federal Subsistence Management Review.
The timing is very important. This is a real opportunity that's been given to the Alaska Native community to find a way for the federal government to properly implement Title 8 of ANILCA subsistence on federal lands of Alaska, which covers the greatest part of Alaska.
The Alaska Subsistence Defense Fund was seeded with $10,000 by the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp. Sea Alaska, Inc., which is chaired by Senator Gukesh, also contributed startup funding, along with the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. The nonprofit will also do advocacy work on behalf of subsistence. A separate organization was formed by the ANB at the same time. The Traditional Food Security Council will support education and awareness about subsistence issues in Native communities. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency tested the National Emergency Alert System for the first time today in Alaska. It used a live code from Washington, D.C., which would allow the president to address the entire nation during a real emergency. Jeremy Zedek is public affairs officer with the state's Department of Homeland Security. He says the state was picked to test the system because Alaska faces such a wide range of threats and hazards.
We have volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, severe weather. So there's a lot of different risks that we face here, and I think Alaskans are just kind of naturally prepared for those hazards.
Today's test at 10 a.m. didn't go exactly as planned. Some stations didn't receive the test at all, and some experienced very low audio volumes or fuzzy sound. But Zedek says, overall, it was a success.
There were some minor problems with different stations throughout Alaska, but that they were a very small percentage, and most of the stations rebroadcast the message loud and clear.
The Alaska Department of Homeland Security is now combing through comments from the public that came in following the test. Director of Operations Brian Fisher says those insights will be helpful as emergency response officials work to build a better alert system.
We are considering this test absolutely successful. We found a few anomalies with equipment and programming, as expected. That's the primary reason that we were doing the test, was to discover those issues so we can move forward and work on resolving them.
The test message was sent from FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C. For a real emergency, it would come directly from the White House. FEMA Assistant Administrator Damon Penn says the president would decide what type of event would warrant using the system.
A large-scale disaster of some kind that interrupted communications to a level where he felt that in order to reach the majority of the American public, he needed to activate the system would be what we'd use it for.
Officials are considering testing the system in other states or holding a national test.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaskans dominated the U.S. cross-country ski championships today at Kincaid Park in Anchorage. Keegan Randall took home her third national title, winning the women's 20-kilometer classic race. And James Southam won the 30-kilometer men's event. He beat second-place finisher Chris Freeman by more than a minute. He says he needed the strong finish to make a strong case to the Olympic Selection Committee.
I needed to put in a good show, you know, to make a statement for the Olympic team. And, you know, being at home, being at Kincaid, being in front of my family and my friends, and it was awesome.
Alaska Pacific University coach Holly Brooks placed second in the women's race, boosting her chances to make the Olympic team. David Norris, a junior racer from Fairbanks, also had an outstanding race, coming in fourth. Southam says he and second-place finisher Chris Freeman had to work hard to shake the 19-year-old.
I knew he'd gone really hard to get us, and then we got to an uphill, and I decided to pick the pace up and kind of make him suffer a little bit. And I looked back, and I was all alone, and said, "Well, I'm going for it. Here we go." So it worked out. So it was pretty sweet.
Snow was falling as the races got underway this morning. Media representative Rachel Steer says that's something skiers don't necessarily like to see, especially on a competition day.
I got here. It was pretty obvious it was going to be a challenging day when you have fresh snow coming down, wet, fat flakes like that, and the temperature is right around the freezing point. That makes classic waxing really difficult. So my heart went out to all the girls who were going to be out pretty much skiing on a couple of inches of new snow.
The U.S. Nationals wrap up on Friday with the classic sprint event. If Keegan Randall wins that race, she will sweep the championships. Poor trail conditions around the lower Yukon have been hampering subsistence hunters this winter. But after a recent snowstorm, hunters are preparing to fill their freezers with moose meat. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
In many areas, snow can hamper travel, slowing down traffic and creating dangerous driving conditions. But in the remote community of Mountain Village, the opposite holds true. Until recently, travel has been miserable because trails, roads, and rivers were snow-free.
It's terrible. I'd say 90% of the town in Mountain Village is all ice.
Martin Alexi is a resident of Mountain Village. Like many, he's delighted after about a foot of snow fell on their community.
Now people are already planning this week to go out this week and because the snow came in.
Lyle Meir, also of Mountain Village, says without the snow, residents were tearing up their snow machines for essential travel.
People were, you know, overheating and their slides were melting, so they couldn't go too far for the moose hunt.
Meir says it's encouraging that people can now go participate in the tail end of the winter hunt.
A big portion of our diet is moose.
The winter moose hunt on the lowest stretch of the Yukon River is relatively new. Alaska Fish and Game biologist Philip Perry.
It's a population that has grown very rapidly, probably about as rapid as you could expect a moose population to grow, to the point where, you know, 10 years ago it was low density and now it's, by most measures, high density.
Now residents in the lower Yukon report seeing moose on a regular basis, and Meir says there's other signs that they're around.
There's wolves coming in through town, and that wasn't the case 20 years ago. And I could only suspect that's because they are following the moose.
The rapid rate of growth for the moose population has been one of the few bright spots in the lower Yukon, where the commercial fishery has all but collapsed and even subsistence fishing has been restricted as King and Chum salmon runs have plummeted.
As this population has grown, it provided a great opportunity for local hunters to harvest moose also. So opportunity is higher, success rates are good, and it's kind of win-win for everyone.
Over the years, state and federal regulating agencies have been liberalizing the hunt. About 12 years ago, there was just one three-week fall hunt. Now there's a month-long fall hunt and a month-long winter hunt. Meir says the winter hunt is changing the way people gather their winter food supplies.
When I grew up here, you know, we didn't go downriver. We drove 250 miles, 200 miles up the river to do moose hunting. And that was usually in the fall time with a boat. And now people are actually taking advantage of the population downriver and doing it during the winter time.
In addition to bulls, cows and calves can also be harvested in the subunit downriver for Mountain Village.
For the most part in rural Alaska, that's kind of the standard we shoot for, is, you know, to have enough of a big game species that it's satisfying a need and a desire for red meat.
The moose hunt will end on both state and federal lands on January 20th. The winter hunt for next year will be extended an additional month into late February. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
All 8 vacant seats on the Anchorage Fish and Game Citizens Advisory Committee have been filled, and indications are that hunting interests have won the majority on the panel. According to Sherry Wright, with State Fish and Game Board support, a record number of people turned out to vote on Tuesday night. The 8 successful candidates were all backed by Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife Alaska Chapter, a hunting advocacy group. Wade Willis, a biologist and organizer of a move to place more members on the board who favor consumptive uses of state wildlife resources, says he's disappointed.
It's unfortunate. The SFW was able to bring people out who would vote for their candidates, and the ADF&G allowed people to come in and vote prior to people being nominated for the seats. So people came in, voted, and left, and never actually heard any of the candidates' nomination speeches or anything. So it was a blatant hijacking of the AC process, in my opinion.
Willis says the voters overlooked many qualified candidates who would have made up a more diverse panel. Dane Crowley, executive director of SFW, says he's happy about the outcome of the election. He says the committee's makeup reflects the interest of the communities it serves.
The consumptive users are the ones who pay for the resource management through licenses and firearms, sporting goods sales, and really those interests are well represented on the advisory committee. I think that there are still several people who are non-consumptive users who are still on the board, including Mr. Willis. So they are representative, and based on the vote last night, they're proportionally represented on the board now.
The AC advises the State Board of Game on hunting issues. The Game Board starts its round of meetings on statewide hunting regulations in Anchorage on January 29th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.